So this is the second part of what I wanted to say about being women in Britain, in particular the development of some moves towards equality. As you know, we don't have complete equality, but there has been a big change over the last 100 years, over the last 200 years. Last week I mostly looked at the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, and we saw how slowly a series of rights were obtained. The right to own property if you're married, the right to go to university, the right to vote at local elections, then the right to vote at national elections if you're over 30, then the right to vote at national elections whatever age you are. Very, very slow. You must remember it was very slow. Between the right to vote at local elections and the right to vote at national elections, 25 years. Yeah? You need to be patient when you want things to change, it appears. So we're arriving in the Second World War, and the Second World War, very different from the first, much more dangerous for civilians, because bombing was the most important element of it. Now, there were far more people died in Germany from bombs than in Britain, because Britain is an island and easier to defend, I think. Also, I know that the British had better radar. And the radar was very important for stopping planes. I'm not an expert on this, but there were technical advantages. There were far more people killed in Germany, but there were a lot of people killed in Britain, and people's lives were transformed. I already mentioned this. People's lives were transformed, and of course women's lives too. So for example, very often working class women would go and work in the factories to make weapons, because you need to make a lot of weapons in a big war like that. Very often their children would leave home. Even little children, they were evacuated and taken to the countryside where it was not so dangerous. But of course this transformed the lives of women. And so here you see a team of engineers. They are repairing buses, and they're all women. They're all women repairing the buses. So of course they had to learn very quickly, but also perhaps, or probably, it made ideas of equality after the war a little bit easier, because it had been so visible. And indeed, after the war, more and more people, more and more women had paid work. The tradition in the 20s and the 30s for working class women was, if possible, don't work when you have children. You work before you have children and after, but stay at home, be a housewife, mère au foyer. This was hard work, because without modern detergents, without washing machines, without vacuum cleaners, etc., it was quite hard work, and also with big families. So it was not that women didn't work, but they had this particular role, which after the war changed. So the number of married women working went from 26% in 1951 to 35% in 1961. Donc les femmes mariées qui avaient un travail salarié, 26% en 51 en Angleterre et 35% en 61. So you can see it's an important change, but it's not. It will take a long time until you have the present situation, which I don't have the figures on. However, when women went to work in 1950, they did not receive the same wages as men. If you were looking for a job, it said in the newspaper, wanted a secretary, £30 a week for a man, £20 a week for a woman. In the advert, in 1960, this was not illegal, this was the normal thing, and the ideology was a man should earn enough money for all his family, and wages earned by women are a little extra, a supplement. Yeah, a supplement. So that's the ideology, the idea. It's not so important for women. Now, this made it very, very difficult for women if their marriage was not working and they separated. Yeah, and they didn't have a job, a trade, that made it very difficult. Of course, today, if you are a divorced woman, life can be difficult. But if you have no job and no skills, then of course it was much more difficult. In the 50s, and especially in the 60s, one of the demands of women who wanted more rights were rather different. The old demands of married women's property, education and votes had been won. Yeah? There was no need for a fight for that. And so in the new period, 1950 to 1980, let's say, then the important questions are, first of all, equal pay. The same pay for the same work. And we will look at this, equal pay. Which means... it's not just a practical question of money, it also means transforming the ideology. It means persuading a lot of people that it's not okay to think that money for men is more important because it's for the family and money for women is just a supplement. So it made a big difference in people's minds. Mentalities had to change. Now, changing mentalities is important but tiring. Changer les mentalités, c'est important mais fatigant. And it's quite complicated. Sometimes you change the mentalities and then you change the law, but often you change the law and then mentalities change. That's something rather unsure. Let me give you an example. In Britain, they had executions until 1965, la peine capitale. And when they changed the law and they stopped executions, probably the majority of the population thought, it's a pity to change the law. But 20 years later, the popularity of capital punishment had gone down a lot. So sometimes the law changes first, and sometimes mentalities change first. This is because history is complicated. This is why it's interesting, yeah? If it was simple, it would not be interesting. So equal pay. Secondly, the right to abortion, donc le droit à l'IVG, which is a long period, and that's the one we're going to look at first. Oh, and thirdly, different measures around violence against women. So let me first look at the question of the right to abortion, le droit à l'IVG. Now, I don't know if you know, but today it is a little easier in Britain than in France to get an abortion. The limit, how many weeks, is not the same. It's a little later in Britain. And the campaign for the right to abortion was very complicated because a lot of people in Britain had a religious objection. Yeah. To the Queen. So it was not just a practical question, it was seen as a moral question, and still is today to some extent, although today there is only a minority who think that abortion should be illegal. But in the 50s and 60s it was a big debate, a big moral and legal debate. When I was a boy, I was in a Catholic school. And the teachers talked about abortion, and they said, do you like living babies or do you like dead babies? Oh, yeah. So let's say that the question was simplified for us, yeah? And of course, I don't like dead babies, I like living babies. Yeah. So we weren't very well informed, let's say. Now, next slide, please. One of the difficulties of the debates presenting itself as a moral debate was, in reality, abortions did happen in the 50s and 60s. Abortions were common and very dangerous. So at the end of the day, the law changed not so much because the government thought, oh, we have changed our minds about the moral question. The law changed because the government thought there are too many women dying in illegal abortions. And if they have abortion in a hospital, they have more chance. So it became a question of public health. Now, this is a film by Mike Lee. A few years ago, 10 years ago, I think. About 10 years ago. And it's a very interesting film, and it's about a woman in the 1950s who went illegally, clandestinely, to see women who wanted an abortion, qui voulait un IVG, and she illegally carried out abortions. And this is a film about her life and how she was eventually arrested and put into prison. And what's interesting about this is that although abortion became legal in 1967, 1967, le droit à l'IVG en Angleterre. But the first big film about the question, 2007, 40 years later, yeah, it was still a very, very delicate question. In the 70s and 80s, I don't think you would make a big film about it. Yeah. So this is a film by Mike Lee, which tells the story. Yeah, Vera Drake, wife, mother, criminal. Yeah, okay. Yes. Absolutely. In Ireland, the situation is much more difficult, and I don't know the exact law in Ireland, but I'm pretty sure it's like Spain. Yeah, that Irish women go to England if they have enough money to go to England. So Ireland is not at all the Catholic tradition in Ireland has been a big obstacle for this. The situation of Catholics in England is divided. In general, Catholics in England think that abortion is bad, but many Catholics in England think abortion should not be illegal, because many bad things are not illegal. And so some Catholics make a distinction between what is legal and what is, in their personal religious opinion, moral. Yeah, which is so, for example, there are many Catholic members of Parliament who have voted yes to the laws about abortion. It's not only a religious question. So in the 1960s and the 1970s, there were many campaigns about abortion. Now, I said that in 1967, abortion became legal, but the conditions were rather strict. And so in the 1970s, there was campaigns. These are mostly from the 1970s. These are campaigns to make the conditions not so strict. Yeah, and this is the National Abortion Campaign. And the slogan that they used was "a woman's right to choose." Yeah, this was the main slogan of the campaign to have easier access to abortion was, okay, you think it's moral, you don't think it's moral, it's not your problem, it's the individual woman who should choose. That's the nature of the campaign. And so you see the March for Abortion Rights. Sometimes campaigns to make the conditions less strict, and sometimes campaigns against a new proposal to abolish the right to abortion. So quite a complex thing going on there. 1970s, 1980s, and of course the badge. The badge was tremendously popular in politics in the 70s, 80s, at the beginning of the 90s, and it seems to have declined. We have the modern version, c'est le mime sur Internet, c'est la version moderne. Je ne sais pas si vous savez ce que c'est des déformations, déviations d'image. But the badge was tremendous. In the 1980s, there were many, 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 many badges. Today, not so much. Now, if we look at 1967, this is the law that said, okay, it's not illegal to have an abortion. There is something very interesting about it. At the election campaign in 1964, the Labour Prime Minister, the Labour candidate Harold Wilson, if you mean PIPA, the Labour candidate Harold Wilson, he did not promise a change to the law on abortion. In the election campaign, they said nothing about this question. But then, when they became the government, they passed this new law. So that's kind of interesting. Obviously, they thought that if they promise in the election campaign, they might lose a lot of votes. And this is perhaps true because most Catholics in Britain are working class people from Ireland or from Italy, and they vote Labour. They don't vote Conservative in general. My parents were the exception. They voted Conservative. Crazy people. And so it's not surprising that the Labour Party said, we're going to change the law on abortion, but don't say it during the election campaign. And so in 1967, there was the new law. And even the new law was not proposed by the government. The new law was proposed by an individual member of parliament, and then the government voted for it. The government said yes, but it was not the government's law. In the British Parliament, any member of parliament can propose a law. Usually they lose. Yeah. And exceptionally, an individual member of parliament proposes a law, and the government says, yes, that's a good idea. And so this was the situation going on. Now, why was it possible to change the law in 1967? Well, first of all, there had been a series of cases in the courts, because if a doctor carried out an abortion, afterwards he could be on trial, and the jury, les jurés, commençaient à refuser de condamner. Yeah, so the juries began to refuse. That way, we found him innocent. Well, obviously, it was clear he had done something against the law, but the jury would refuse to convict. The second big question in the campaign before the law of 1967 was the question of money. A journalist said, in the West End of London, the rich part of London, there are 10,000 abortions every year by expert doctors, secretly. And in the East End of London, where the poor people live, there are many abortions which are dangerous, without good doctors, etc. And so the campaign said, it's not fair. Rich women, they have abortions. And all rich women can go abroad, go to another country. But poor women were having a terrible situation. Every year, about 30,000 women were in hospital after an abortion, which did not go well. Donc il y avait 30,000 femmes chaque année à l'hôpital à cause d'un IVG qui s'est mal passé. So big numbers. This was big numbers. It wasn't three or four. Yes, this was big numbers. Now, of course, it's very difficult to know how many illegal abortions there were, because when things are illegal, you don't have statistics. But that was the sort of general situation. This is David Steele. David Steele was an individual member of Parliament from the Liberal Party, so from a small party, not from the Labour Party, not from the Conservative Party, and this was the gentleman who proposed this law in 1967, and the Labour government said, okay, we don't want to propose it, but we do approve it. I think it's also the case that public opinion was moving slowly. Public opinion was moving. And more and more people believed that abortion was an individual choice, your choice, not a big social moral question. This is similar to the situation with homosexuality, which I will talk about next week. In the 1960s, people began to think, oh, it's an individual problem. It's an individual choice. It's not society's job to decide, are you moral? Are you immoral? Are you moral? Are you immoral? So the idea that the government's job was to protect morality slowly, after 1945, slowly declines. And the idea that individual choice is important slowly rises. This is also connected with changes in the way people live. In the 1930s, you live in a house, next door your parents, then your brother and sister, a very communal, so a very moral community. There are advantages, but the disadvantages, you can't do anything different, everybody knows. Whereas in the 50s and 60s and today, people move a lot, and so you have a much more individual choice. Now, of course, more individual choice probably also means more individualism. Yeah, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. I think also that because in the 50s and 60s, more women, not so many women, but more women had good jobs. You began to get women doctors, women lawyers. Of course, there had been women doctors in the 20s, but you know, very few. The number of women doctors, women lawyers, women teachers was rising. And these women wanted to decide, how many children do I want? I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, how many children do I want? I want the number which allows me to continue with my career. And so these middle-class women were very important to the campaign because, of course, they knew how to write letters to the newspaper, how to appear, be interviewed on the radio, etc. They could carry it along. Next, please. Now, really, the second wave feminism arrives at after 1968. When we talk about feminism in Britain, we often talk about first wave feminism, second wave feminism, third wave feminism. Of course, this is a simplification. The first wave is what we talked about last week, the suffragettes, the right to vote, etc. The second wave is the 60s and 70s, and the third wave is today. Yeah? We'll come to the third wave in a moment. So, second wave feminism after 1968. So again, the inspiration probably comes mostly from the black civil rights movement in America, which inspired the entire world, but and also from the victory of the Vietnamese, where people were saying, the opposition are too big. Vietnam beat America, and you think the opposition is too big? So it was a tremendous inspiration. You know, it sounded impossible. Vietnam won against America. It was completely transformed people's view of the world. So the new campaigns they established women's campaigns organized by women, and very often only by women. And here we have some examples. Here on the right you have Spare Rib, which was the most important magazine for feminism in the 1970s and 80s. Je ne sais pas quand ça a disparu, peut-être 90, quelque chose comme ça. So, first of all, the title is very interesting, Spare Rib, donc Code supplémentaire, donc référence à l'histoire de la Bible où Ève est fabriquée à partir d'une côte dont Adam n'a pas besoin. So it's very British. It's a humorous title, Spare Rib. Yeah? And you have inside a whole load of discussions about questions which nobody really mentioned. For example, here, the problem of the boss who has two mobile hands with his secretary. Now, this is, in general today, this is taken rather seriously. Yeah, le harcèlement sexuel au travail. People think, that's a problem, it needs to stop. Now, unfortunately, in the 1970s, very often people thought, it's not a big problem, men will be men, it's natural, etc. Yeah, this was the general idea. You can still hear these ideas, but it's a minority today, whereas it was really almost everybody. So here you have, on the boss's lap for Christmas, back under his thumb next year. On s'assoit sur les genoux du patron à Noël, mais l'année prochaine on est à nouveau sous son contrôle. An article there, what has the revolution done for women in Cuba? Quelle est la situation des femmes au Cuba? And I think what is interesting about Spare Rib is it was very independent. It was not very much influenced by the Labour Party or by the Communist Party or by others. There were some communists and some Labour people. There always are, but it was quite independent. So that was quite new. And on the other side, you have a postcard in Kazakhstan from a company called Leeds Postcards. Postcards to Leeds in Vila. And they produced a whole series of feminist postcards, which can be quite funny. And here you can see a little boy and a little girl. Ah, voilà pourquoi on n'a pas le même salaire. Il regarde. Et il dit, ah oui, c'est pour ça. So the postcard is mocking the idea that it is natural for men to have more money than women. It's pretty good, I think. That's pretty good. Next slide, please. Yeah, here is another example of a feminist magazine from this time. Yeah, The Shrew. Alors, Le Shrew, comment est-ce qu'on dit shrew en français, j'ai oublié. C'est une femme qui est considérée comme étant trop intellectuelle quand elle ne devrait pas. C'est ça, shrew. I'm not sure. Okay. So, in England in 1970, there was the establishment of the Women's Liberation Front, le Front de Libération des Femmes. Now, the name of the organization is very important. The Women's Liberation Front comes directly from the name the Vietnamese Liberation Front. You know, there was no Liberation Front before the 1960s, so they chose the name from the Vietnamese situation. They wanted a movement which was not hierarchical. Of course, in general, in political parties, you have a vertical structure. You have local groups, and every year you have a conference where every town sends a delegate and they elect a central committee. That's the normal way a political party works. And many people in the feminist movement said, though, this is not good. This is the way that men do things. It's a masculine hierarchy. And we want something more horizontal. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't work. Yeah. The advantage of having no hierarchy is that you don't have the boss telling you what to do. The disadvantage is that sometimes it's chaos. Yeah. What can you do? There was also a big debate in the women's liberation movement between two completely different ideas. On the one hand, there was the ideas of patriarchy, what we sometimes call the ideas of radical feminism. And on the other hand, there were Marxist ideas of women's liberation. So what's the big difference? Well, patriarchy theories, la théorie du patriarcat, says that the central dynamic of society is the division between men and women. So for example, if you want to understand war, la guerre, if you want to understand war, you need to look at the role of men and the role of women and how war maintains masculine power. All the important aspects of society, in the opinion of the people, of the radical feminists, are linked to this division where men try to maintain their power. On the other hand, some people in the women's liberation movement were Marxists. They said, no, the central dynamic of society is economic. It is the bosses trying to make money from workers, and the division between men and women helps capitalism. So we must try to have equality between men and women, because this will make it easier to win better conditions for everybody, and eventually, in the long term, to eliminate capitalism. So you have these two very, very different ideas, both of them radical, both of them wanting big change, but not agreeing on what is the central cause and what is another effect. And this debate between patriarchy theory and Marxist theory continues until today. Alors, j'essaie de le présenter de façon relativement objective. Ceux qui lisent entre les lignes, ils savent que je suis d'un côté et pas de l'autre, mais je ne vais pas vous le dire. Now, one of the reasons that patriarchy theory, radical feminism, was very popular was because radical feminist says, okay, you're a Marxist. Look at the Soviet Union. Are women equal? No. Look at Cuba. Are women equal? No. Look at China. Are women equal? No. So their conclusion was, so Marxism is not so good. And on the Marxist side, you had some people close to Russia and China who said, let's talk about something else. And you had some people who said, you're correct, but Russia, China and Cuba have abandoned Marxism, and that's the reason. So here you had the three theories. I don't want to go into great detail. If the question interests you, I have written many articles about this. So, these are the kind. So you have the women's movement of the 1970s, which is probably thousands of women, not millions, thousands of women, groups in every town, and from time to time, big demonstrations. Not often, a big demonstration about abortion, a big demonstration about equal pay. Etc. But not often. It's not a mass movement of millions, but it's an important movement where in every big town, if you went to Manchester, you would find 10 feminist groups to go to meetings and debates and writing and so on. And a certain number of books were very influential. This is one of them. Ça a été traduit en français sous le titre Toilette des Femmes, and this was a 1970s book, and it's about middle class women whose lives are, entre guillemets, perfect. They have a nice husband, they have nice children and a nice house, and they are horribly bored. And it's about the lives of women, of middle class women, who in theory have a perfect life, but in fact find that they are very much denigrated and not at home in the world. This sold millions. It's an American novel, but it sold millions. So this is just one example of the books which suddenly posed the question in a different way, and people would read them and discuss them and so on. Here we have another postcard from Leeds Postcards, and she's doing the ironing, and she's saying, "Ah, vive le ménage, j'adore ça." Yeah. So I think we're supposed to take it as ironic. Yes. Okay. So there she is. You know. And here is another example. This is the 1970s again. And this is an advertisement for a car, Fiat. And this is a real one, it's not an imaginary one. And it says, if it were a lady, it would get its bottom pinched. Alors, la publicité que je pense ne passerait pas aujourd'hui, c'est si cette voiture était une demoiselle, on lui mettrait la main aux fesses. Genre, elle est tellement jolie, vous voyez. Alors, je crois que ça passerait plus aujourd'hui. Je crois que, quand même. Non, mais bon, c'est pas si rigolo. Donc, vous voyez l'idée, c'est que quand un homme met la main aux fesses d'une jeune femme, c'est rigolo, c'est à rigoler, c'est pas un problème, c'est à rigoler, c'est tout, c'est ça l'idée. Mais là, nous avons une graffiti féministe. Si cette dame était une voiture, elle vous renverserait. Yeah. Okay, so very, very, quite good, a good reply, muscular reply. And this was made into a postcard, which was very, very popular in the 1970s, the postcards. Interesting idea, the postcard. Postcards were very popular in the 1970s. When you went on holiday, you sent postcards to everybody. That's not so common anymore. Let's see. Combien de personnes ont envoyé plus de trois cartes postales de leurs vacances dans l'année dernière? Levez la main. Ah, ça existe encore, c'est bien, je suis rassuré. Il y a quand même beaucoup de gens qui... Ah, ils sont nuls les autres, hein, ils l'ont même pas fait. Oui, voilà. Ok. I only send a postcard to my mother. Okay, so just an example of the debate. So when graffiti is part of a debate. That's good to talk about. There were many other debates inside the feminist movement. A lot of debates. So you're talking about a movement, not very organized, very, very informal, of several thousand people, 10,000 maybe, and lots of debates. Some people said, we need campaigns with women and men together to make things better for women. And other people said, no. We need campaigns with only women. We need meetings with only women. We need newspapers with only women. And this is what we call separatism. So why? Well, let's have these two people. This is the people saying, we need women and men together in the same meetings, in the same newspapers. And these people say, no, we need only women. So let's have the debate a little bit. Why only women? Well, because when you have 10 women in a room and 2 men, the men do all the talking. And these are the kinds of arguments, yeah? That the tradition that men's voice is more important makes it too difficult to have mixed meetings. So we want only women meetings to be sure that women are heard. Okay, so this is the main argument, and the debate continues. It's interesting to see that today in Britain, most meetings are men and women together, but, for example, in the trade unions, every now, from time to time, they have a meeting with only women to talk about particular problems. So that this feminist idea that sometimes you need only women meetings has become accepted in the trade unions today, dans les syndicats anglais. Ce n'est pas rare qu'une ou deux fois par an, il y a assemblée générale seulement des femmes syndiquées, pour parler de certaines choses. C'est-à-dire que ce sont des syndicats mixtes, toutes les réunions sont mixtes, sauf de temps à autre, ou parfois régulièrement, une fois par an, il y a un week-end que pour les femmes syndiquées. Ok, so this idea changed. Now, this separatism sometimes had some difficulties, because you have here then the women who said, we only want women in our meetings. But then sometimes you had discussions and say, I'm a black woman, I'm a white woman. I need meetings with only black women in the meetings because white women don't really understand racism. Yeah, and so sometimes you could get quite a lot of different meetings, which has been analyzed in various different ways. Yeah. Now, I ought to reply a little bit, because if here you have the people saying, we need campaigns with only women, over here you have people saying, yes, but if you have meetings or demonstrations with men and women, they will be more bigger and more powerful, and we will win more easily. Yes, no. Yeah, the debate, that's a debate, yeah. It continues. And sometimes, let's say, it was sometimes difficult to decide to make the link between the need to discuss separately and the need to act together. It was not easy, yeah. And I have my opinion, but I might be wrong, so don't listen to me. One of the important aspects of the women's movement of the 1970s was to say that to change lives for women, it's not enough to change the law, equal pay, okay, equal promotion, okay, that's not enough. That they said that oppression, the difficulties of being a woman in our society, are also in everyday experiences. Who cleans the toilet in your house? Is it sometimes the men, sometimes the women? Is it always the women? These kind of questions. And here you have a poster. recognize and fight against everyday oppression. Il faut reconnaître et combattre l'oppression quotidienne. Donc ce n'est plus là une question des lois, etc. And you can see the pictures, yeah, on the top left, it's a man's hand. Then the next one is makeup, that many of the feminists said the pressure on women to be pretty all the time is very heavy. And then the next one, housework. Do the women have to do all the housing? And the next one is a form. À l'époque, quand on remplissait un formulaire, souvent une femme devait mettre toutes les informations sur son mari, de son mari. Elle ne pouvait pas, par exemple, contracter un prêt sans l'approbation de son mari. That kind of thing. So here you have a different. Examples. The last example, I don't know if you can see, is women being in competition for how physical they are. So the young woman is looking at the woman who's going to have a baby and say, oh, I'm not a good woman, I don't have any children. And the other woman is looking, oh, I'm not a good woman, I'm not beautiful enough. So this is the idea of the psychological pressure on women in society to be, you know, to be perfect in these different ways. I know that most of you know more about this than me, but I know about the history. 1975. Some particular groups had particular ideas. Some particular groups had particular ideas about the best way forward. For example. They noticed, of course, that most housework, la plupart du ménage, is done by women. What can you do about this? Well, it's quite complicated. First of all, because, for example, men usually work longer hours. And this is not just a matter of choice. If a man and a woman say, okay, we need more money. Somebody must work overtime. Quelqu'un doit faire des heures supplémentaires parce qu'il a besoin de plus d'argent. Normally it's the man, because normally his wages are higher. And it's stupid to ask the woman to do extra time, overtime for not so much money. There's an economic logic which comes in. But this particular campaign, this was not a big campaign. This is just one example of a small campaign. He said, what we need is that the government should pay all women for housework. Un salaire pour le ménage, que le gouvernement devrait verser un salaire à l'ensemble des femmes parce qu'elles font le ménage. Now, this was not necessarily a realistic proposal because the government was not going to agree, but it was a way of emphasizing, of telling the world, look at all this, look at all this work which is being done by women without money. This was also a big argument in the feminist movement and in the Marxist movement. When women clean the house and look after the children, who are they working for? And some of the feminists said they're working for men. The mothers and the cleaning the house and looking after the children is work done for women when men should do half of it. And the Marxists said, well, that's partly true, but really they're working for the bosses. They are producing new workers, the children, they are producing new workers for the bosses, and they are making sure that the husband is clean, fed, and ready to work again. So again, you have this argument of what is at the center of society. Is it the economy or is it the relations between men and women? Here we have another amusing feminist postcard. Two men saying, le ménage, ça me pose plus de problèmes depuis que je me suis rendu compte que je suis un mec, moi. Okay, so it's a slightly unusual, indirect. It's not very good propaganda because it's not easy to understand, but it's quite funny. It's quite funny, yeah. And these, of course, the pictures are taken from old films or old advertisements. Okay, we're going to stop for exactly 5 minutes, and then I'm going to continue.